on this episode of Backdrop.
I don't know. The way I've always kind of gone about it is like, you got to care more than everybody else and you got to work harder than everybody else. And if you do, that'll come through. And sometimes you don't get the break, but sometimes you do, you know, and you got to hope to get that break sometime.
David Reamer is a food and food lifestyle photographer with something to say. Actually, a lot to say. Born in New Jersey, but currently settled in the culinary hotspot of Portland, Oregon, he has an East Coast work ethic balanced by a very laid-back West Coast attitude. Originally a cook himself, a run-in with a Ford F-150 while riding his bike on the streets of Portland would change his life for good, and for the better. Forced out of the kitchen to heal, he found his love of photography would be all the physical therapy he'd need. Since then, he's been documenting the beauty of food and the personalities who prepare it. His love of simple, unfussy cuisine is as strong as his Jersey accent. Hear about all this and more on this episode of Backdrop. Hey, this is William Anthony, the host of Backdrop, and today we have a good friend of mine and a very talented photographer, David Reamer. How you doing, David?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming down to the studio and having me on your show.
Absolutely, no problem. Now, we've known each other for a couple of years since I first moved to Portland. As a matter of fact, I still remember the day that we first met. It was at the Portland Monthly. Was it a Christmas party, I think?
I remember this
and
yesterday.
You came running up to me, and you had your tie on and a vest, and I'm like, look at this dapper guy. And next thing you know, you're like, are you William Anthony? And I was like, do I owe you money?
That's funny, because that's not how I remember it. But if you ask my close family, I tend to reinvent my own past, so I could definitely be wrong.
It was very nice, though. You came up and you said you'd seen my work, and we were instant friends, I like to think.
So yeah, right on.
A couple years now.
I'm glad you remember it that way.
We'll go with my narrative, shall we?
Yeah, yeah. No, I do remember that. You were talking to Nicole about meeting her originally, and that remembrance popped in my head where I was like, I don't want to go to this party. I don't like going to Christmas parties. And then I was like, oh. And that was still when I was seeking out other photographers. Now I run from them. But
yeah,
at the time, I was like, ooh, a photographer.
Well, and honestly, when I started the podcast up, I thought to myself, okay, who am I going to reach out to for interviews? And there were some that came to me over time, and then there were some that came to me immediately. And I'd like to tell you that you were in the immediate column. So
I'm flattered. I really am. Well, I don't think I'm that interesting, but hopefully I will prove myself wrong.
We'll leave it to the comment section.
Yeah. Cool.
Which is the, I think, the eighth level of hell is the comment section. But we are here in Southeast Portland, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to be posting some photos of your studio on the Instagram feed and probably the Twitter feed as well. Even though as of now I think I have 5 followers on the Twitter feed, but we got to boost that. Hopefully these photos will help. But it's a really interesting space because it's just flooded with beautiful, beautiful daylight. You've got the natural God softbox outside, which are Portland overcast clouds. And it looks like you have quite the collection of dishware, plateware, glassware. Is this stuff you've been collecting for years and years and years?
Yeah, I mean, you've been to my house. You know, I like stuff. And you know, as we'll probably get into in the interview, I sort of had to, out of necessity, become my own prop stylist. Yeah. You know, I was easily my own food stylist, but I needed to become my own prop stylist. So I started sort of collecting, and that sort of went crazy. I love estate sailing. I try to do it every weekend if I can.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff, I mean, there's got to be 2,000 pieces at least in here.
It's a museum.
Most of them are food, drink related.
Yeah.
But then there are those pieces that I find that I'm like, I just have to own this because I don't want anyone else to own this.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a little tour of that after the interview and show you some of the secret pieces that are tucked away.
Ooh.
But there's some treasures.
Can I make an offer on that Playboy glass?
Yes. You can take it with you as a memento of the interview, for
sure. I can't
sure.
post that one on Instagram unless I blur out the nips. Free the nip. Anyhow, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. David Reamer, David L. Reamer, you are not originally from Portland. I'm not going to hold it against you. Neither am I. But you are from New Jersey. Is that correct?
Born and raised in New Jersey. Went to the University of Delaware and chased a girl. I'd always wanted to go to California. You know, since I was a little kid, I saw the Surf and Safari album, and Beach Boys were in the studio in bare feet, and I thought that's the coolest thing I had ever seen, and I figured out where they were, and I said, I'm going to go there when I can.
Yeah.
So I went to University of Delaware, went to Europe for a couple months, you know, wandered around, and then headed out to California with some friends. Uh-huh. Spent about 5 years in California, ate some different friends, And then we all headed up to Portland. And I've been in Portland for about 15 years.
So what year are we talking?
2002, I think.
Okay.
I think I came to California in July of 97 and then Portland in July of 2002.
Nice. Where in California?
Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was
a little off from
I was chasing a girl. She had been living there and had was giving up her apartment and we got to move right in. It was I was sitting in Delaware with a friend that who had a car and I wanted him to go out there with me. And I'm talking to her on the phone and he was a surfer and he said, ask her where how far she is from Steamer's Lane. And I said, how far are you from Steamer's Lane? And she said, 7 blocks. And I repeated that to him. And he nodded his head and he said, I'll move with you to California. And that was it. It was done. He and I. And then we took one other guy who just decided to come for the road trip for the summer.
Oh, nice.
And then we sort of became like a youth.
This is downright bohemian, man. Well, I never would have pictured you.
We graduated a little earlier. So then for the next couple of years, as people from Delaware were graduating and just going to sow their oats for a little bit, they would come crash on our couch. And one of our neighbors dubbed our apartment the East Coast Youth Boys Hostel. Because it was just constantly, and it was a bunch of really cute girls that lived in our complex that we were just friends with, but they just had the pick of the litter.
Yeah.
We just have dudes coming through for a couple of weeks. They'd hang out, they'd make out a little bit. We'd go out drinking, and then they'd hit the road again, and it was great.
So wait, in Delaware, what did you study?
English.
Oh, okay.
So I was an English major. I was not allowed to be a photography or an art major.
What were you told to be when you grew up?
I don't know, like...
You just took English because it sounded interesting?
So my dad is a chemist, my mother's a librarian. So growing up, I really had all the support I needed from the science and math side and all the support I needed from the English lit side. I tended to be more into the English lit side than the math and sciences side.
Yeah.
And, I told them that I was going to go to Santa Cruz and go to UC Santa Cruz and do a grad program in English. And I don't even think UC Santa Cruz had a grad program in English. Don't tell them that. But, that was the big plan. And I was like, I'll be a, college professor, which sounded fun because,
So this brings me to the next obvious question then. When did you decide that you loved photography? Do you have an origin story? Somebody bought you a camera? What?
Well, hopefully there'll be a picture put up in 1982, would make me born in 74, so I was 8. Mm-hmm. There was a Polaroid, Polaroids were brand new, and there was a Polaroid contest through, I think, the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And my dad had a coworker that had just bought a Polaroid, so he borrowed it and he bought a roll of film and he said, wander around the backyard, take a bunch of pictures.
Yeah.
We'll enter it. Because I guess I very, very early, remember setting my teddy bear up on, the edge of the garden and shooting natural light, even back then, None of this strobe nonsense. I'm pretty sure they picked all the winners out of a hat.
But your first camera was a Polaroid.
My first camera was one of those little box cameras that had the tiny little shutter release on the side.
The Instamatics.
Yeah.
The cartridge film.
Right, the cartridge film. That was the first one I really had. The Polaroid was just something, it was very expensive when it first came out.
But you liked it. When you held the camera, you knew there was something special there.
Absolutely. Any trip I was on.
You were the guy. You were the photographer.
I remember, I think after eighth grade, my parents took us down to Disney World. And that was one of the first, we did a big road trip. We went to see my cousin in North Carolina. And I had my camera with me the whole time. And I remember there was something, and I took 3 pictures of one thing. And it was like I took a wide angle, I took a vertical, mm-hmm. and I took a horizontal or something. And I remember my mom was like, I don't understand. It's just a thing. Why did you take 3 pictures of it? And, that was just it was a sentinel moment for me because without ever having been told to,
you went beyond the snapshot.
That you want to make sure you get that shot, you know?
I think it shows that you saw things differently. And that's truly, I think, what separates the average photographer with, an iPhone from somebody who takes it seriously.
And I didn't take any photo classes when I was little. I did a lot of art class. We did a lot of art classes, painting classes.
Yeah. It translates.
We were certainly a visual family. There was always art books around. There was a lot of fine art prints on the walls growing up. I recognize a lot of that
stuff. So when you came to Portland and you were cooking, at what point in time did you say to yourself, maybe getting burns on my arms isn't what I was made for, and instead maybe I need to enter the easy freewheeling world of food photography? When did that transition happen? What started it?
That happened when I got run over by a Ford F-150 a month and a half into moving to Portland.
Okay.
But let's go, that's actually going a little ahead. Let's go back a little bit.
Yeah, let's, and you please. Can re-edit this. I don't know anything about it.
Really?
You never told me about getting hit by a Ford. I want to hear this.
Changed my life. Okay, so I was in Santa Cruz. I wasn't cooking. I went to Santa Cruz and I was working at a photo shop.
Okay.
24-hour lab that was, you just sat in a dark room, stoned, earphones on, just running prints, running prints on these huge rolls all day long.
Yeah.
It was terrible. It was terrible. And I was like, this is not what I want to do. So a neighbor friend got me into catering, and I was just doing front of the house catering, and I didn't really like it. And the ladies who own the catering company were really cool. And I said, I have a little bit of chops as far as food goes. I would really love to learn from you guys if I could be in the kitchen. And they welcomed me and they showed me so much stuff. They were super kind to me, really amazing, amazing people. And so I got into cooking. And from there, I kind of worked for a couple different catering companies, and then started working for a catering company that opened a restaurant.
Okay.
Where I met one of my best friends, dude Christian, who used to live in California. He went to Nicaragua and opened a restaurant. He's living in France right now, has his own restaurant.
Okay.
Incredible guy.
Jealous.
He's a good dude. And so he and I were kind of working in this kitchen, and then he left, another chef came in, blah, 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 blah. And at that time, one day, the chef and I are out front smoking cigarettes, hungover, trying to argue about who's going to make creme brulee for the day. And
who's going to run the torch?
Right. Well, no. It's the baking is the bitch. It's not the making. It's the making it. But so up comes this lanky kid in like chef gear and wants to know if he can have a job. And the chef looks at him and goes, "Do you know how to make creme brulee?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Cool.
You're hired.
You're hired. Like, can you start?" And he was like, "Yeah." And so that was Gabe Rucker, fame. And so then that chef left, and me and Gabe were left running the kitchen together. And
This is Santa Cruz?
This is in Santa Cruz.
I didn't know you met him in Aptos. Okay.
In Aptos, which is two towns away. Yeah. So, I mean, for 2 years, Gabe and I cooked probably 60, 65 hours together in a kitchen, golfed on our day off together, got, you know, drunk 4 to 6 nights a week together.
Now, it's worth noting, he's a Beard Award winner now.
Two, if not three times over. Yeah. At least two.
Yeah, he's kind of the rock star of Portland.
And that was actually obvious back then.
Was it?
He was going to go to New York and go to school, and I convinced him not to, purely for selfish reasons, because I really liked hanging out with him, and, you know, was like, don't go to New York. Yeah, like, let's golf. So anyway, long story short, we both really got burned out on Santa Cruz. So he and I and his best friend from high school, sight unseen, drove up to Portland. We had heard all these cool things about Portland, and Portland was still super cheap. I mean, it's 15 years ago. We borrowed Gabe's mom's cell phone because none of us had one.
Yeah.
And we gave ourselves 3 days, and we found a place, super cool people, super cool house. And went back there 2 weeks to wrap everything up, and then we just drove to Portland.
And this is kind of the heyday of Portland food scene, because that was back when...
Well, this is pre.
Because Andy Ricker doing Pock Pock, that was still an old house, wasn't it? I mean...
No. That comes years later.
Was it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. There was, at that time, there was pretty much... I think Zeffiro had gone under, but Wildwood was the only restaurant that had a cookbook.
Yeah.
Paley's, this was before Paley won the Beard Award, which was really, that's kind of to me the mark of everything changing when, in
that
Portland, was when everybody
before
paid
before and after Paley.
But like, you know, Simpatica hadn't started up. It was still Beyond Meats up on 23rd Avenue. Yeah. There wasn't really much going on.
Isn't it crazy to think how different Portland was just 10 years ago? I mean, it seems to have completely flipped over.
But I mean, if you talk to somebody from 20 years ago, they'll say the same thing. If I think if you talk to somebody 30 years ago,
I'm going to push back a little bit and say that I think that the change in it's not change that I bemoan. It's fast exponential change that I bemoan because it just I don't think people or cultures are made to change that quickly, and it just feels like a like an invasion on some level. But that's just me being an old fart, I guess. Right.
Remember, we promised we weren't going to talk about social media or the downfall of Portland
Okay. Sorry. So anyhow, so you come to Portland.
So we moved to Portland, sight unseen, no jobs, no nothing. And we get this super cool house. And we are all kind of looking for jobs. We're kind of just messing around a little bit. And not even a month and a half in, I was just riding my bike on Woodstock. And a lady driving a Ford F-150, I don't know if she was playing with her phone or she wasn't paying attention, but she turned into me, hit me on the side, plowed me over, my knee snapped in half, you know, everything was kind of jolted. And that was the beginning of a very rough year. I mean, you know.
Because you couldn't work?
I couldn't do anything. I had to have knee surgery, and I went, I mean, long story short, you know, I went to the surgeon. And they were like, well, unfortunately, nobody knew what had gone on, so they had locked your knee down. So now it's completely atrophied. So now with a completely shredded knee, you have to do 3 months of hardcore physical therapy just to get your knee muscles back so that we can operate on it so it takes well, because I'd have an ACL replacement. Then I had another year of just absolutely brutal, brutal physical therapy.
So I'm going to guess then that while you were down and out, you picked the camera back up.
I was shooting and, you know, I was just shooting anybody because that was when I think Gabe was then working at Paley's. This was before Gotham was a thing. I was laid up at home. I had some money, but I didn't have any friends or a base. So I was just kind of friends with friends, and people would come over to this big house that everybody partied at. So I was just taking a lot of pictures. I'd set up two different dark rooms in Santa Cruz. Yeah. Set up a dark room at the house here. So I did a lot of printing. You know, I was shooting. I ran into a guy at New Space. And he sold me a Mumia 220 that totally changed my view on everything.
I remember
everything.
You had a series that was hanging at City State Diner. That was all black and white or sepia or duotone images of like restaurant equipment.
That was up for a bit. Those actually now are hanging at Tasty and Alder.
Was that from that era?
No, because those are huge.
Oh, okay.
Those are much, much later.
Sorry.
This was more just me roaming around with the Mumia and learning that instead of having your camera at your face when you're walking around and you see somebody you want to take a picture of, I went to San Francisco for a couple weeks and just kind of hobbled around and met some people. And I found that when your camera is at your waist, people are not only much more likely to be willing to be photographed, but they look right at the camera because they don't know what it is and they're very curious about it. So you get these amazing
You can't
portraits.
Do that anymore, though. Now, I remember I have a Rolly 3.5 and it actually gets more attention. I got it. I remember I bought it when I had a Hasselblad and I sold it. Because it was just a cinder block around my neck, and it was getting to be too heavy. I only needed it for the magazines for commercial work. And once I wasn't shooting film anymore, I decided to go with something a little smaller when I sold it, and I decided to get the Rolly because of Vivian Meyer's work. And also Stanley Kubrick shot a bunch of stuff on subways when he was a kid. Same reason. Actually, he had a bulb in his sleeve to set off the shutter so people wouldn't see it. If you ever get a chance to see Kubrick's subway work in New York when he was a kid.
Oh, there's another photographer I thought that did that. He would sit in the subways and he would hide it in his shirt.
Yeah. Kubrick didn't invent it. Well, he might have invented it because he was doing it in the 40s.
Anyway.
But anyhow, I understand what you're saying. And it's true when you've got a twin lens reflex and you're looking down, people back in the day wouldn't look at the camera, they'd look in your face. Although now, inevitably, I pull the Rolly out and they go, ooh, is that an old camera?
Right.
You end up having the conversation.
Well, I like the Mumia because it was the only twin lens reflex that you could change lenses on.
Yeah.
And then that was pretty awesome. And that was I met Jake at Blue Moon two, 3 months, couple months into being here because...
It's a good guy to meet.
Ugh. To this day,
yeah,
he's one of the best.
So you get knocked off the bike.
So
you get back on the horse.
That like I you know I go through a year. I'm shooting photos. I mean, I've been shooting photos my whole life. I've been shooting photos in college. I've been shooting photos in high school. You know, I'm doing what I have to do. I always have a camera with me, always, for, for my whole life. But it's just me shooting for fun. I just love doing it. I have 30, you know, binders of negatives and contact sheets in my basement. Totally. You know, but so I'm here and I'm shooting a bit. But when push comes to shove, I need to make some money. So I start cooking again. And I'm bringing my camera into the restaurants and just shooting the people, shooting the lifestyle, shooting what I can. And then I see an ad one day for Willamette Week needs a new photographer. And I was like, all right. So I print up a bunch of, because it's all still film. Yeah. I print up a bunch of pictures from being in the restaurant, put them in a little book, went and met the dude at
2004?
Yeah, give or take.
Yeah, yeah.
2004. Okay. Went and showed them the stuff, and they were like, this is great. Go shoot some more food. And I was like, I kind of want to shoot portraits. And they were like, we like your food stuff. Go shoot some more food. So I go shoot food, and I bring it back. And they're like, this is great. Go shoot some more food. And I'm like, I kind of want to be a portrait photographer. And they're like,
editor yeah, feedback.
Doesn't matter. Go shoot some more food. And, you know, it was at that time that I was catering with the Simpatica guys who have since gone on. You know, John went on to do Toro Bravo and the Tasties and all that. And
all stars.
And the other three guys went on to do Laurelhurst Market and, you know, Reverend.
It's a tight community, the chef community in Portland. It was, I remember anyway. Is it still?
I think so. I, you know, I'm people honestly not in it as much as I was.
It seemed like there was a period in time when chefs from New York and L.A. and God knows where else were actually coming to Portland to kind of do their little laboratories to try out new cuisine or restaurant concepts or whatnot. Has that jumped a shark yet?
You know, I don't really know. You don't know. I'm not as up on it as I used to be. You know, I think there was a time when folks would come in for other areas, and if they came in humbly and they said, I want to see what's going on, I'm interested in the scene, they were welcomed with open arms. Yeah. And then there were certain people that came in with the, you don't know what you're doing, I'm from New York.
Oh,
and like,
yeah.
Did not go over well. And there were a couple of people who crashed and burned because of that attitude. But really,
that's universal.
When you talk about that, you know, once Gotham kind of came and went, and then when Gotham ended, it was sort of the diaspora that became the highest point in Portland's culinary scene. That was not just because people were connected to Gotham, but sort of all roads led back to Gotham one way or another. But like, you know, you had Toro starting, you had Pock Pock starting, you had Bunk starting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Le Pigeon had started. Paley's was going strong. Like, I, you know, forgive me to anybody else who I'm, you know, Simpatica was like reinventing.
There's too many to remember
cool
all at once.
Catering at that time. Like, everybody was doing something really rad. And suddenly, like, I've literally shot for the Willamette Week, and I have GQ emailing me.
Yeah.
Like, saying, we contacted this restaurant and they said contact you.
Well, that brings me to an interesting point that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, as photographers go, we're always looking for opportunity. We're always looking for contacts. We're always looking for leads and building relationships with people. And at what, was there a certain point where you decided, okay, I'm going to just shoot food and food, or I should say cuisine culture, if you want to call it that. Because when I look at your work, it's not just dishes, obviously. It comes through that you're an old school shooter and you like to photograph. I mean, one of the reasons why I love your work as much as I do is because it's not just overhead shots of food. Is you're seeing people over the grill, you're seeing people at the beach, you're seeing people, you know, roasting something. There's, I mean, food, you know, it's part of our culture from the cave days. I mean, there's... Anthony Bourdain, bless his soul, said, you know, you want to understand somebody, eat with them. And I think that really does make a lot of sense. So I want to see the people that are making the food that I'm enjoying, not just the food. So when it comes to leads and networking and whatnot, did having worked in the kitchen, did that give you an advantage, do you feel, in becoming a food photographer?
Absolutely. I mean, I was just at the right place at the right time. When I started shooting, there wasn't really a need for a food photographer in Portland because there wasn't much food to photograph. Yeah. So there were two or three people that were shooting food more than they were shooting other things.
Yeah.
And I looked at their work and I said, I can do that. I can do better than that. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm was very personally staked in that world. So I didn't want to just show the newest, coolest plate. Like, I wanted to show the cooks. I wanted to show the dishwashers. I wanted to show the blood, sweat, and tears that went into that world, because it was even at that time, it was just starting to become really cool on TV, where there you were starting to get all these reality shows. And people were just romanticizing the shit out of it. And it's like, no.
You are literally photographing how the sausage is made. It's not a euphemism for you.
Right.
It's a double-edged sword. I mean, you're literally photographing the nitty-gritty part of cooking, and I think that that really separates your work for a lot of people.
And I think at that time, there was this real kinetic energy that was going through all of Portland, where everybody was feeding off of each other, and like there was no one-upmanship. It was just everyone was really stoked, and it was just this perfect point in time. And I'm just here, like, I mean, I remember the Willamette Week being like, we really want to get a picture of the burger at Le Pigeon. You know, do you think that's something you could work out? And I'm like, well, I guess considering Gabe's my roommate, it probably shouldn't be that hard. And they were like, and I saw like their pupils dilate and was like, we can get this done, you know? And it was like, at that time, I was either cooking with, drinking with, or golfing with
Gabe and those guys.
Just everybody so that drank or golfed.
It's safe to say that you got your break with Willamette Week.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at that time, Portland Monthly was still so new. I remember calling the Portland Monthly offices and getting the art director.
Yeah.
I forget who it was, the bald dude. Just got him on the phone. Cause he liked Gabe and he knew Gabe, and I said, hey, I want to shoot for Portland Monthly.
Yeah.
And he said, do you have a digital camera? And I said, no, but I have some money in the bank so I could just go get one. And he kind of laughed and he said, look, dude, there's a little bit more to it than that. So get a digital camera, figure out how to use it, and then give me a call and we'll talk. And I said, cool. And it took, you know, years later and some other random people getting me in there, and I finally got my chance to do that for a while, which was great. But like back then, like now, you couldn't just call Portland Monthly.
It's such a trade-off now, because the cost of entry, the literal cost of entry, is so low now. I mean, you literally go to Pro Photo Supply and you buy a camera, a couple lenses, you're in the biz.
Mm-hmm.
But getting over the castle wall is so much harder now, because there is so many people doing it. And I imagine, and it's one of the things I was really interested in talking with you about, and I want to get to it later, though. It's about the camera eating first when people on social media, and we're not going to talk too much about social media, I promise, but it is important to talk about, because I do think it has affected your genre enormously.
Sure.
More so than others. But I remember those days. I mean, I got my break by literally same sort of thing in Seattle. I called Seattle Magazine. I wrote an email to the art director and said, hey, do you need a photographer? And I got my first assignment that day. It just doesn't happen like that anymore. It's so much harder now. And so I feel for the younger generation or people just getting into it, but then I kind of don't. Because it's, they don't have to do the film thing.
I mean, everybody's
thing.
Got it tough.
Yeah.
In the 40s, true. They had it tough too. You know,
it just like, changes.
Well, yeah, it's a different. Walls are built, and there's always going to be somebody who has a key to the back door, and you just can't compete with them. But that happened then, it happened now, it'll happen 20 years from now. Like, I don't know, the way I've always kind of gone about it is like, you got to care more than everybody else, and you got to work harder than everybody else. And if you do, that'll come through. And sometimes you don't get the break, but sometimes you do, nice. You know, and you got to hope to get that break sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think that makes a lot of sense. And having known these people and having the connections and whatnot, did that lead to the cookbook work? Because I know that you've done a lot of cookbooks in addition to editorial work. Did that start with Gabe?
So the first book I shot was called Pure Beef, and it was based around a grass-fed beef ranch.
You see it right there?
Out in Joseph, Oregon. And it was a food stylist who I had known just a little bit, really cool woman, who recommend it was a small publisher out of Philadelphia, and they called me and they said, look, we only need like 10 dish shots. We can shoot it in a studio in Philadelphia, or I can get a free trip out to Oregon and we can hire you to do it. And I said,
road trip.
And before, luckily he didn't ask me what kind of budget I would have laid out, because it would, like, he just said, this is all the money we have. And it was three times what I would have quoted him easily. Nice. It was crazy. You know,
Philly money.
Don't get me wrong. It wasn't good money.
No, I know, but it was more than you thought.
It was just good money when you're a cook. And so that was pretty awesome. And then I think the next book I did was Le Pigeon, and that was with 10 Speed. And I just took it for granted
What's 10 Speed?
10 Speed Publishing.
Okay.
Is one of the biggest names. They do some of the biggest, most popular, most pushed books. Okay. Really gorgeous, gorgeous books. Not that they're the only ones.
And did they hire you partially from Gabe's recommendation and what they saw?
Well, I guess they saw enough. I just assumed that, like, well, it's Gabe's restaurant. Gabe wants to use me, and that's the way it goes. That is not the way it goes. I got very lucky that they were just like, no, you're not doing this. Like, they could have easily said that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they had seen my work. I guess, you know, they knew our personal relationship and story. So they said, and that was really great. To, you know, just as a quick side note, like, Gabe had gotten really into the food scene. I was doing other stuff. And we had, you know, after, I don't know how many years it had been, but it had probably been close to 10 years of friendship. It was definitely the furthest we had kind of spread apart from each other. Okay. He had his own life. I had mine. And that book just re-cemented our friendship. It recreated a collaboration and a friendship between us that to this day is as strong as it ever has been.
That's awesome.
And I think if that book hadn't happened, we probably wouldn't be very close friends anymore. Not out of spite or anything like that. It's different worlds, different things happen. But for 2 years, he and I kind of worked together nonstop to make that. And at the same time, I was shooting the Toro Bravo book. So that was literally 2 years of my life at the same time.
And did you traveled with them as well, didn't you?
And I mean, John is one of my best friends. And, you know, I've known John as long as I've lived in Portland almost. And yeah, so we went, he took us to Spain for a trip for that.
Now, I'm not saying you don't deserve any of this, but you realize how charmed you are, right?
I do. I absolutely do. I've said it 100 times. Like, if this all, which is why, you know, you look at the Instagram superstars and you want to get angry, but you're like, you know what? If this all falls apart tomorrow,
still pretty awesome.
I had a hell of a run. I had a hell of a run, you know? I really did.
Well, don't throw the towel in yet, man.
No, I'm not. I'm scrapper.
So, you're shooting cookbooks. You're enjoying it. You're busting your ass, though, right? Because cookbooks, tell me, I've never shot a cookbook, and I'm sure listeners out there that are food photographers are going to roll their eyes, but is it tough? Is it nonstop work? How many images do you deliver for an average cookbook?
You know, I'd have to check my blog. So, one book I shot was, the whole book, was, the Pure Beef book was shot in 4 days. An egg book with a food stylist and writer in town, Andrea Sloniker, who's amazing, amazing food writer. And that was 10 days of shooting, you know, like kind of nonstop, but that was it. Mm-hmm. The Toro book and the Le Pigeon book were 2 years. I mean, and you have, talk about organizing folders.
Jesus.
When you just show up and they give you 9 dishes to shoot, you can't title your folder those 9 dishes. So like, It got
day one.
You had to,
day,
I mean,
two.
Being a Scorpio, I have my own sense
Wait,
of organization.
You're a Scorpio? I didn't know that.
I'm a Scorpio from two Scorpios who's married to a Scorpio.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch my back.
But, you know, those were more, obviously, more labors of love.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't put a monetary value on the work that you do. Because it's so intense. I mean, you just give up your life. When the chef says, we just got in gooey duck. We just got in padrones. We just got in something. We just got in these mushrooms, and they're gorgeous. You need to get over here and shoot them right now. You just stop what you're doing and you go do it.
It's seasonal.
Because
your photography is seasonal.
Well, that is the irony, because all the like magazines are like, we need you to shoot this, you know, 7 months before it runs. And you're like, but there's,
can't do
there's
it.
No. Like, do you know how many times I've had to go
still
into a kitchen like a jerk and be like, hey, so they want me to shoot morels. And they're like, yeah, morels are wild mushrooms. They only come. And I'm like, I know, but I have to walk in here and I have to say that to you so that you can say that to me so that I can go outside and call them and tell them that there aren't going to be any physical morels for several months. You know, but you got to do that.
It's got to come from the chef's mouth.
But
well, you know what? The other thing, because I haven't shot any cookbooks, but I've done a couple of food shoots here and there in my life. Not as many as I used to. But there is one advantage to shooting food, and there's a lot of times you get to eat the subjects. Have you eaten a lot of good food in the course of shooting?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you know, even that, it kind of wears thin after a while when you know that you're just, cause like,
well, tell me about a time where you were shooting something and as a chef, you were like, oh, I can't wait to eat this thing. was there a dish? Is there a cuisine that you can't resist? And don't say stuffed peppers.
Usually foie gras. You know, foie gras or tartare.
Okay.
Those are the two that I absolutely love, that I don't eat that much. I don't go out of my way for it that much. But if it's on a menu, I'm usually going to be shooting it for whatever reason, or I ask for it to be shot, you know? But it's normally, if I'm there to shoot food, I'm shooting nonstop for four or 5 hours. And it's just plate after plate, plate after plate. And you just don't get to say like, oh, can I have a glass of Viognier? I'm just going to sit down and enjoy this foie gras real quick. Because they're like, dude, the burger's dying in the window. Get it on the table.
Or you eat it when it's cold after you've done shooting.
Right, that's usually how it works, is it gets pushed to the side and then you eat it much later. But any chef would rather you just go back there and be like, hey, I didn't get a chance to eat that foie gras. Would you whip one up for me?
Yeah.
You know, and you can do that.
So now with your work, obviously it's all, or at least it is now, because I remember when I first met you, you did a little bit of strobe work, but now you're pretty much all ambient daylight. Is that right?
Yeah. I assisted for a hot minute with some very, very talented people who taught me very, very quickly that I wanted to do nothing of what they were doing, that I was just not a strobe dude, and I didn't get it. And then one time I got to be a third assistant on this big Converse shoot for LA photographer.
Now, this is here in Portland?
Up here. It was a four-day thing. I got pulled on just as an extra set of hands. And all I had known was, like, any big money type thing was all strobing.
Yeah.
And these folks rolled up, they brought two strobes, one of which broke en route. The other one they used for about 20 minutes the first day and then never touched it again. And they did four full days, and we're talking RVs and craft services and Digitex and this whole thing, but just them running around shooting, and it changed my whole perspective on everything. You know what I mean? It validated the fact that I could do what I wanted to do and perhaps at some point do it at that level. That you didn't have to have
that
the bronze colors
fit your personality more.
Yeah, well, it really just because I couldn't afford, like, you know, when you're shooting $50 shoots for.
Yeah, but I'm not hearing you saying that you pined not being able to shoot strobes. I'm hearing you saying that you love ambient light and that's what you want to relish.
I do. And, you know, people have come and they're like, oh, do you want to teach a class on food photography? And I'm like, it would kind of begin and end with, like,
finding a good window.
Get a window. Yeah. Get a window and maybe a bounce card.
I'm curious, is there any science behind this in that I feel like when I look at images of food, when I see a photograph of food lit with natural light, it looks more appetizing to me. And I think, and I'm not going to get into social media, but I am going to say that with all of these, you know, people photographing their food before they eat it, the whole brunch joke, I feel like there's a new, sort of renewed sense of authenticity. I hate that word, but the bottom line is it's relatable when the food that you eat looks like the food you see the photos of, or I should say that backwards. The food photos you're looking at is the kind of food you would eat. Because, you know, in the old days, 80s, 90s, when they would they'd light these things, I remember going into grocery stores and going over to the meat section and above, the butcher, there's this big mural of lit cuts of meat, and that's just so disgusting.
No,
it doesn't look appetizing at all. And so is there any science behind it? Do you find that just by what people are asking you that natural light is just more appetizing? People like that more?
Well, I think that followed suit in the idea that the editorial aesthetic was kind of coming in across the board.
Okay.
And that sort of ushered in that more that real sense that people were getting away from the giant studio, three ring circus type things. But I mean, I remember, you know, maybe 2 years ago, I was talking to somebody and they're like, did you shoot those McDonald's billboards that are around town? And I was like, what? And they were like, it just looks like your style. And I was like, okay. And I went, and for the first time, I saw you see these McDonald's billboards, and it's like they're on like weathered wood. And you know, it's you can see it's kind of like natural light, or at least really, really, really well post-produced to look like natural light. But it doesn't look like bullshit fast food photography.
It's not shellacked burgers.
Right. It really looks real. And I think somebody realized, like, why not do that? It looks so much more appetizing.
Yeah.
It just does. I mean, I've put food on the floor. Mm-hmm. I've done...
It's also texture. I mean, again, I'll try to get some photos of your studio space up on the Instagram page, but... You know, I'm looking at what looks like the top of a picnic table. I'm seeing marble. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful textures. And again, I feel like it puts the food in an environment as opposed to removing the food from an environment.
It just grounds it slightly.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a lab experiment.
Right. I'm not a seamless guy. And I feel like when you put a plate of food on a seamless, it's floating in space forever.
Yeah.
You don't need to have, you don't want the surface to be distracting, but you just need a little bit of personality in there, and it just creates a whole vibe around the photograph.
It's food as something appetizing and not food as a product, because, you know, seamless is for product, is the way I look at it. So I understand that you've done some work out at the coast. I believe it was for a salt company that you did kind of a, what is it, like a chef's gathering sort of thing?
Ben Jacobson, super rad dude who has Jacobson Salt, who, you know, you probably know in town. He has this house that's on the property where he does all of his salt production.
I've been there. It's pretty far out of the way. I mean, it took me a while to find it, but it's beautiful.
It's on Drinking Whiskey Road or Whiskey Swerving Road, whatever that is. That road that runs up to Cape Lookout.
Neatarts and right on Tillamook, Neatarts, where people will recognize the name by the creamery.
Right. So you get to Tillamook and then you head out. People don't really realize that Tillamook isn't actually on the ocean.
No,
you have
it's
to
not.
Get to the ocean. And so if you go out and a little south, you hit Neatarts Bay, known mostly for their oysters. The Neatarts oysters are amazing.
Yeah.
So he's got this beautiful property, beautiful house. He's got some kayaks and some canoes that he lets you take out. There's a little boat launch
like
right
a slough
there
out
into
there,
it.
So that's great for making salt.
And so what he was doing for a little bit, it was really fun, is he would just have chefs who used his salt would come out and cook a dinner. And I got to go out a bunch of times and photograph it. And doing it with Gabe and doing it with, you know, Vito Paley was so much fun. And like pressuring Paley to have a martini when he didn't want to have a martini, and then getting him, you know, having him have that second martini so that he couldn't drive home. So, and I was like, you got your own room. We're going to have a fire tonight. We're going to hang out. And like,
now, for people that don't know Paley, full name, and he's legendary.
Vitaly Paley, one of the greatest dudes in Portland, old, old, old school Portland dude.
Props here.
And I prepped at his restaurant. So he and I met that was my first real cooking job after my accident. Because I was going through rehab, but I was getting really antsy. Gabe was cooking there, and Gabe was like, man, I gotta go out with Vito and do this wine dinner, and it's just the two of us because there's no extra hands. You know, it sucks. We're gonna get. And I was like, let me come. He doesn't have to pay me.
Yeah.
Just let me come. Oh, can I tell someone's story? You can totally cut it if it gets too long winded.
I'm never gonna tell you to be
so
quiet.
Okay, this is my favorite cooking in Portland story, and it's pretty much like my first one.
All right.
I've never really been, I've run kitchens, I've been in kitchens, I've never been in a kitchen as small and as high pressured as Vito's kitchen.
Really?
I mean, everyone's in their whites.
How many stars? He's up there, right?
Like, well, this is... I mean, he got a Beard Award for Best Chef, and that's kind of when everything really blew up for him.
So this isn't a bunch of hipsters. This is like full-on cuisine, like...
Yeah, this is before hipsters.
White like, linen. We're talking...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Nice.
This was like no fucking around.
All right.
Like, this was serious business. And so I tell Gabe, like, let me come along for the day. And he asked Vito, and Vito says, sure. I said, you don't even have to pay me. He ends up paying me a little bit, but I'm like, you don't even have to pay me. I just need to get out of the house. I can do this. So I'm in the kitchen, and the kitchen is so small, and everyone is like so focused because they have so much to do before service starts. There's not even like a tabletop for me. I'm on a reach-in freezer next to a window with a little cutting board, and I am scared to death. And so I'm doing a bunch of stuff, and everybody's
mise en place. Like you're getting.
I'm prepping for the party, so everyone else there is prepping for dinner.
Got it.
I'm there. No one knows me, and I'm in their way, prepping for a really fun event in wine country that they don't get to go to. They're going to be stuck in the restaurant,
doing
and
service.
I get to go out and hang out with Vito and be his pal for a day.
So you're the anonymous asshole in the corner,
right. And so nobody is giving me an inch. You know, there's nothing. So I'm nervous. I have this long, thin knife that I think I'm like cleaning fish with or something. I'm doing some stuff. I don't notice. The knife flips up on its edge.
No.
And I run my entire hand across the edge of the
knife.
Blade. Cutting through three of my fingers. Not horribly. You don't need stitches, but bleeding quite nicely.
Okay.
But there's nothing I can do. I don't know where the Band-Aids are. I can't just go to the bathroom and fix it like if I was working somewhere and throw a glove on.
And now you're making a mess somebody else has to clean up.
I'm a fish out of water, and I look like a jerk. So I'm holding my hand, and I go to Vito, and I was like, I'm really sorry I cut my hand. It happens. Cooks cut their hands. Ask any cook that's ever worked with me. I cut them more than anybody else does, but you cut your hands. So I'm like, all right. And that restaurant is an old house, and so the offices and there's other prep rooms and there's stuff upstairs, and it's a carpeted stairs going up.
Did you trip?
So Vito goes, all right, we got stuff upstairs, we'll bandage up. So he's going up the stairs, I'm holding my hand in my other hand with my kitchen clogs, I'm running up the stairs, I slip on the stairs, boom, face plant right behind him, wham. He turns around and looks at me, he goes, dude, We need you today, man. Pull it together. And I was like, I'm cool, Vito. I'm cool. I swear to God, I'm cool. Just, you know. I was like, Mr. Wolf.
I got to use that someday.
I'm cool, Mr. Wolf.
We need you today, man. Get it together.
He's like, just get it. He wasn't mad. He's just, get it together, man. So, taped up my hand, put on a glove.
And
John was like, I'll do it. And it was, I mean, he doesn't like get to be besties with his cooks or people that he knows right away. But we were both East Coasters, you know. He had just had back surgery and was recovering from that. I had knee surgery. So we're, you know, talking about PT and what we're dealing with that. And, you know, we just hit it off.
It's kismet, man. I swear, like, these moments and the fact that, you know, you had it and I don't want to say you took advantage of it, but the fact that it wasn't just a sort of...
It was just right place, right time.
Yeah, but also it's the ability to, I don't want to say leverage those experiences, but to not just let them go to waste.
Right.
You know?
Well, and I knew that there was something there. So right after that, so I got to be the extra guy who got to go do fun stuff. If there was a dinner on Sauvie's Island, I got to go do it. If there's dinner in Wine Country, I got to go do it.
Because you didn't have many friends in the kitchen?
Right. They were just like, yeah, oh, you're here. Oh, great. So you get in our way, you take up a bunch of really necessary refrigerator space, and then you get to go have fun with Vito
stuff.
And drink wine in Wine Country. Like, and then you come back and drop off all your dishes and leave.
Bleed
like,
on everything, right, goddammit.
Right. So, yeah, we have another podcast just on the bonehead things I did at Paley's. And it would be 45 minutes.
Yeah, we'll come back for that someday.
But so right after that was when Vito won his award, and they had never had a prep person. It was only the full kitchen staff would come in to do their own prep. And he started getting very busy. So I became a one-day-a-week prep person, and then they got busier. So then I became the three-day-a-week prep person.
Nice.
And then less than a year later, they were up to 7 days a week doing prep.
So, have you shot for Paley?
Well, yes and no. Vito actually gave me my very first real assignment, which was to shoot the farmers that he... It was really big before it was big
the
for
farm
Vito
to table
work
thing.
With the farmers that he knew that he respected.
Yeah.
He hired me to go drive around and shoot all these farmers, printed all these beautiful images. They're still hanging at Paley's. One of them is actually hand printed. The rest are digitally done.
Yeah.
But one was the medium format.
I'll look it up.
But he had always worked with John Valls, who's another amazing food photographer in town, had been shooting. You know, I remember being a prep guy at Paley's and John coming in one time and shooting a dish, and I was kind of peeking out from the kitchen watching. And was just like, fuck, I want to be doing what he's doing.
You really?
Know?
That was
like,
the moment?
Really. And John was so great when I was starting out. Like, I was super intimidated. And he, I don't know what else he was doing then. I know he was mostly doing food, but I called him and like, he talked to me for like an hour and a half. He just answered all my questions. He wasn't guarded. He wasn't trying to like, you know, tell me that not to do it or, you know, he was just...
No sense of competitiveness.
He was just super, super cool. And he's... So when the Paley's Cookbook came about, like it was of like there was no way that I was in the position to even try to do it. And John got to do it. And John's done a bunch of cookbooks since. So John has pretty much always... And Vito's always kind of been like... You know,
but
he
knows. But Vito knows you're a shooter now.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that.
We run into each other whenever we can, and
that's great.
It's always fun.
At least do you have a portrait of him?
I do. Yeah. No, I definitely. I have him. Him and Kim. I mean, if you know Vito, you know his wife Kimberly, who is.
I don't know either one, but
firecracker.
Well, that's cool. That sounds like a really, really great experience. At least when you first started out, both as a chef and as a photographer, getting the opportunity to watch someone. Who wasn't necessarily a direct mentor, but at least you got to see how it worked.
Well, I learned so much. I mean, that was a real kitchen, you know, like that wasn't a go fuck around kitchen and have some drinks when nobody's looking. Yeah. Like that was serious business.
That's serious.
Way too serious for me. I lasted for a while, but I did last.
But as far as seeing the photographer doing what he does, what was his name?
John Vowles.
So seeing John Vowles' work was kind of a catalyst for you to get into photography.
Well, I got to see someone. I saw someone, I guess, for the first time, come to a restaurant, take a plate of food. I think he was actually shooting strobe that day, although I know he does some natural light stuff. But like, and I think he was there for like Food and Wine or something. And just to be like, wow, this dude gets paid to go to a restaurant, shoot food, and then walk away. And like, that's awesome. Like that's a thing that you can do.
So when you decided to do it yourself, did you just start looking at other people's work and try to figure out how they shot it? Did you just kind of go on what, you know, your gut instincts told you? How did you change it from something that looked fun you could do on the side to actually making it your mainstay income in business?
It was an evolution that took many years that, you know, and like, I just want to state for my own record, I was never like, I was a chef in Santa Cruz for a little bit. I was never a chef here, and I was never even really a line cook. I line cooked for a little bit, but I did not have the chops to do line cooking. Like
now, to people that aren't in that world, a line cook, there's like, you know, prep cook, line cook, sous chef, chef. Is that? I mean, are there other labels?
Yeah, there
and they
are
all
others,
change?
But it's, you know,
so chef is the boss. He's the boss of the kitchen. He's the general of the army.
And
all that sort of
you have chef de cuisine, who's more the working chef, and then you have executive chef, who's more the owner chef.
Does the menu and that
sort
of thing. And then you've got the dessert guy and the salad bar.
There's a lot of gray area in the middle.
All right.
But for all intents and purposes, I was a professional prep cook.
Got it.
And I was really good at it. And prep cooks, I mean, it's hard work. Yeah. It's nonstop. But it's different. You know, you're there earlier, and then you walk just after service. The line guys, I mean, it's just a talent that I didn't have, you know, and I didn't really want it by the time I could have gotten into it.
Mm-hmm.
I did it for a little while. It was fun, but it's, you gotta be such a masochist, like a real, like not even joking. Like you have to want the pain, and that's just how it goes. But, brutal.
So is it safe to say that food photography is not as difficult as being a cook?
It's different. It's different.
Different set of stressors.
You're just dancing to a different tune. You're still dancing.
Yeah.
You know?
We're all dancing.
Right.
Come on.
No, but definitely. I mean, I saw what I wanted to do. And again, like it took me years. For a while, I was cooking 80% of the time. And if I had 2 days off, I was shooting both of those days, either for myself or if I could land a Mercury gig or a Willamette Week gig or something
Well, I do want to point listeners to your website, which is dlreamer.com. Is that correct? Because there's some wonderful Holga stuff on there. Or there was. Do you still have that up?
No. I took it down. But if you go to there's a link to the blog.
Okay.
And the blog.
Yeah, because there's some stuff there that's just absolutely. It's lyric. I mean, that's
transplendent.
Just
transplendent.
Yeah,
I just watched Andy Hall last night.
Scrabble. How many points is that?
Well, I watched Andy Hall to get ready for this. So,
oh, you did.
Transplendent.
Wow.
is a word that Shelley Long or Shelley Duvall.
Yeah.
Shelley Duvall uses when they're there to see the Monarishi.
So to wrap up then, you've got a website, dlreamer.com. You're on Instagram. Is that the same, dlreamer?
It is.
Anything else people should know about how to see your work? Tell them maybe a couple of cookbooks they can look for, the ones you're real proud of.
Sure. I mean, the
Le Sell Pigeon, yourself.
The Le Pigeon cookbook is great.
It's not Le Pigeon.
It's not. It will. I think I was just reading something the other day about him where it, you know, it specifically is not. If you call it Le Pigeon, you are pronouncing it incorrectly.
Okay, good
it's
to know.
It's Le Pigeon. The Toro Bravo book in the same way was, I mean, a two-year journey with one of my closest friends and a restaurant that is just absolutely amazing.
I love it. As a Spanish person myself, I love going there and eating their food.
I just shot the cover and I'm wrapping up a book right now with Steve Jones, who is sort of the cheese czar of Portland and has been for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And he's doing a book. It's 75 different specific cheeses paired with specific wines, specific cider, and specific beer. So you can go to any cheesemonger anywhere and say, this is the style of cheese I want.
So wait, you're shooting this or you already did?
We just shot the cover, so the rest of it's done.
Need an assistant?
What's that? Yeah, we got to eat a lot of cheese.
I can hold a reflector. Basque was, sheep cheese. That's my thing,
fun.
Man.
And that was a full studio book. That was really fun to do.
So, and speaking of Le Pigeon, you're also shooting his new restaurant.
Well, so I just got tasked with re-documenting all three of his places. So for the last 2 weeks, I have been 2 hours here, 2 hours there, 3 hours there, 5 hours here, doing Little Bird, Le Pigeon, and Canard, which is a new spot.
Yeah.
And it's just been great. You know, it's just been great to hang out with all those guys and to, you know, talk about getting to snack on food afterwards. Yeah. You know, and
one last question. If you had a choice for a final meal, what would it be? Don't think too hard.
Something that my mom cooked, I'm sure, just to say that. She used to make a mushroom chicken, you know, with like Campbell's mushroom soup and just flour and seared off chicken. And that, you know, nothing tastes better than nostalgia. So I'll take that over.
Sure.
Bells and whistles.
The new cuisine.
Right, well, which is great, you know, but it's, you know.
I just want to say thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you. I hope you got some usable material.
Absolutely. Did you have fun?
I think I only cursed like 4 times.
Well, I knew it was going to be an E for explicit, so fuck it.
I had heard some other cursing on, so I was like, I'm not going to be the only
don't
one.
Don't worry about it.
But I tried my best to sound professional.
I'm really glad I finally got to hear some of the backstories, and I learned a lot more about you in this process, which was also something I was hoping to do. And I think you've given a lot of good information. A lot of times when I talk to seasoned photographers, they don't realize how much wisdom they have to impart until they just open their mouth and start talking. So
sure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And with that, we're going to end yet another episode of Backdrop. A big thank you to my guest, David Reamer, here in Portland, Oregon. Again, check out his website and his Instagram feed to see some of the work, and get out there and eat some good food. Thanks.
Thank you.
Backdrop is made possible by the kind contributions of the following. Music by Kevin Robinson. Branding by Radical Co-op. Cover photography by Nicole Clementson.
You guys ought to do a story about me sometime.
Why should we do a story about you?
Because I'm so f***ing good. That ain't no shit neither.
Would you or someone you know like to be a guest on the podcast? If you have an interesting perspective on photography in any of its forms, drop us a line at thisisbackdrop@gmail.com. You can also visit us on the web at thisisbackdrop.com or connect with us on Twitter and Instagram at thisisbackdrop. If you have the stories, we have the microphone.
Is he in Jersey?
He could be. He could talk you or I under the table, I'll tell you that.
I got a guy that does my taxes. He's my You know what'd be funny is I should do this in my shitty, bad, fake Jersey accent.
Where I was going to broach that subject.
So, David, tell me a little bit about cooking.
People say that I have an accent. I don't hear it.